Oh, and thanks for being here. I'm Brian Price, and I'm the producer of tonight's Dakota Reader. I want to welcome each and every one of you to the South Dakota Art Museum and the first in a series of Dakota Reader lectures on audio art, radio broadcast, and audio theater. Before I introduce our guest lecturer tonight, I'd like to mention that the series is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and the generous support of the South Dakota Art Museum. Tonight's program will be an overview of more than 70 years of science fiction on radio and recording. It's entitled, The Best Aliens Are the Ones Only You Can See. And Jerry Stearns, our guest speaker here tonight, has seen a lot of aliens in his time. I think the best way to describe Jerry is to say he was science fiction before science fiction was cool. Now, all his life, Jerry has been an avid reader, listener, collector, broadcaster, and creator of science fiction. He maintains one of the most visited audio theater and science fiction websites in the world. That's www.greatnorthernaudio.com. And he's been on the air programmer and talent for community station KFAI-FM in Minneapolis for over 20 years. He's one of the few people in the country that consistently plays new science fiction audio on the air. I imagine early on, Jerry was attracted to radio science fiction because it so quickly transports the listener to new places and new spaces by asking them to use their imaginations. Imagination is a very powerful tool. You can go anywhere with it. And in those broad strokes of the 40s and 50s radio broadcasts, distant planets, distant futures, and questions of our very perceptions were all available at the turn of a dial. As stories and tales using ideas and scientific facts always intrigued Jerry. He likes stories that make internal sense. So if a character shows up in another dimension, he wants a good explanation for it. And that's what makes good speculative science fiction work. Curiosity is another main ingredient of science fiction. And as a child, Jerry took apart clocks in the basement and later became a computer nerd. It was all downhill from there. Jerry is a true science fiction fan. Now you might say, yeah, big deal. Everybody is one. But in the classic science fiction sense of the 60s and 70s, fandom was and is an integral part of how science fiction gets around. Fans have conventions. They trade books and ideas. They argue about whether transporter technology will really ever exist. And they celebrate the genre. Now, Jerry has taken that celebration to the next logical level, which is a creative level. He's become a professional. He writes and produces his own work. A lot of it's pretty silly, and that's his style, and that's his view of a very absurd world. He's a working colleague of the luminaries in our little niche of audio theater. People like Tom Lopez of ZBS Productions and David Osman of Fire Sign Theater, these are people who are creating audio fiction at this very moment. Jerry has won numerous awards for his work, like the 4th Annual Mark Time Award for the production of 407 Arachne and the 1993 National Federation of Community Broadcasters Golden Reel for Solid State University. He's a member of MISFITS, which is a Minnesota Society for Interest in Science Fiction and Fantasy, a member of the National Audio Theater Festivals, and he's president of the American Society for Science Fiction Audio. He's also a founding member of Sound Stories and a partner of Great Northern Audio Productions. So I can think of no better person to take us on a tour of science fiction on radio, tape, and CD. He's heard most of it. He's played a lot of it. He creates it. And best of all, like any radio guy, he loves to talk about it. So please welcome Jerry Stearns.
Thank you. This is great. I can't see a thing out there. See, that is really great because the whole idea of this is that not that you see it through your eyes on the outside, but that you see them through your eyes on the inside. That's one of the reasons we've kept it dark in here, because I'm going to bring you several examples of what I talk about, and I don't want you to be able to watch me during this. I want you to maybe close your eyes and let the audio take you to some other world. And we're going to go to some strange places tonight. Actually, the title of this has the quote slightly wrong, but I think it's my fault. But I will give you the precise quote. "The best special effects are the ones inside your head. The best aliens are the ones that only you can see, and you only see them in your own mind." David Ossman said this at the presentation of the first Mark Time Awards for Science Fiction Audio in 1997. What I'm going to talk about tonight is a fairly quick overview of the concept of science fiction on radio. There was a lot of it before, and it's still being made today, and we certainly won't be able to cover everything. I'm going to talk about the very best things, which is purely a subjective point of view, the things that I like the best anyway, and we'll stop and talk about a couple of the most important programs that have been made. I'll illustrate with excerpts from some of the best in the field. I won't mention the bad ones unless there's something historically significant about it. So first I want to mention that the term sci-fi is not considered a term of praise to fans of science fiction. It's called SF, not sci-fi. Sci-fi is what you call it when it's done badly. Think of 1950s science fiction movies. That's sci-fi. Okay, the first thing I get to do is introduce you to a really square sort of fellow. His name is Hugo Gernsback. Hugo was in his 20s when he immigrated from Luxembourg to the United States in 1904. Almost immediately, he began his own business and by 1905 was selling little tiny home crystal radio sets by mail order. In 1908, he started a radio magazine that was called Modern Electrics, which was largely articles about electricity and inventions. And then he changed the name in about 1912, I think, to The Electrical Experimenter. That's what Hugo was interested in. It was science and getting other people interested in especially electricity and radio. But he found that when he published what he called a scientific romance in the magazine, he had a little spike in the in his circulation. He would get a few more subscriptions. So he began publishing these stories that would take you on a little journey and show you how science works in the world. He did a series of stories about Baron von Munchausen, if you've ever heard that name or seen the movie. He created that character and then in his stories would have him travel to Venus or to Mars and then radio back what he found there. See, radio was the part that he was talking about. He never explained quite carefully or fully how he got to Mars. That wasn't the important part. The important part was the radio. During World War I, Hugo would kept publishing his magazine and telling people about advances in radio and new inventions, even though radio broadcasting had been banned by the Navy for, of course, security reasons. But he kept telling people he wanted them to be able to be ready to carry on with radio broadcasting and listening when the ban was lifted. And it was eventually in 1920, and radios suddenly jumped out of every corner of the country and millions of them were sold in a matter of 2 years. In 1920, Gernsback changed the name of his magazine again to Science and Invention, but he kept publishing these stories and to help people learn science and make it more interesting and fun. From the idea of publishing these little scientific romances, Gernsback published in April of 1926 a new magazine called Amazing Stories. This was the first true science fiction magazine as considered in science fiction fans to be probably the most important event in the whole history of science fiction. To publish this, he coined the term scientifiction. And that very quickly just became science fiction, even in the magazine. So Hugo published the first radio magazine, he published the first science fiction magazine, and he created the term science fiction. Now, we know a little about him and his background. He's going to come up a lot as we go through here. The earliest known radio play of any kind, at least in the United States, was called The Wolf. And it was literally a play done on a stage, and they put a microphone in the middle of the stage. The play was not written to be performed on radio, and people keep fading in and fading out as they walk around the stage doing the play as they normally would. That was in 1921. The earliest known science fiction on radio was a program called Ultraviolet. Nobody's ever heard of that one. Ultraviolet was written by Franz Stryker, who went in to write lots of radio. He wrote a lot of scripts for The Lone Ranger and The Green Hornet, which, in case you never knew this, The Lone Ranger and The Green Hornet are related. But that's a different story. Ultraviolet began as a series in 1930, and it was distributed in a rather unusual way. He published the scripts and sent them to radio stations, who then performed them with their own cast and crew. It was all done live, and that's why there are no recordings of Ultraviolet surviving to this day. However, almost all of the scripts have survived. They are really bad, and that's why nobody has published them or anything either. Okay, that was 1930. So I'll back up just a step. In August of 1928, that issue of Amazing Stories carried a serialization of William Nolan's novel Armageddon 2419. The main character was this sort of ordinary guy, a very good athlete, who started out in modern times and went through suspended animation to the year 2419. His name was Buck Rogers. The characters were picked up almost immediately by comic strips and were syndicated, so it was natural that the first network radio series of science fiction would be Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. This was on CBS Radio Network in 1932. It started as a daily serial of 15 minutes, but it was on and off the air and changed in various lengths from 15 to 30 minutes, but it was on almost continuously until 1947. Science fiction at the time was a pulp fiction genre. As such, it was aimed largely at the young, and it was considered to be rather a low level of literature, and certain people would not even read it. I have heard of people who would not let it in their houses. They assumed that the radio audience would be mostly the same. The Mutual Radio Network also took its cue from these pulp magazines and the comics and did a short-run serial of The Amazing Interplanetary Adventures of Flash Gordon starting in 1935. Just last year, a group in San Francisco called the One Act Players released the first episode of a new production of Flash Gordon, taken directly from that original comic strip, but using all of the latest audio technology to make it. It's quite remarkable to listen to, and there's only a 15-minute episode. And I think they have more episodes done now, but they're only available on the World Wide Web. For those of you who are taking notes, that's oneact.org. And since they were digging material out of the comics, the most logical next program would, of course, be Superman. That began in 1938, starring Bud Collier as the mild-mannered reporter, and then went back and forth between 15 and 30 minutes and gained and lost sponsors on the Mutual Network until 1949, and then switched to ABC until 1951.
Rogers in the 25th century.
And a shower of silver dollars from Popsicle Pete's money box.
Rogers, who is held in suspended animation for 500 years and is now adventuring in the amazing world of the 25th century. By turning a little dial to project us ahead in time, we're able to be right with Buck and his friends in the wonderful world of the future, a world that sees a lot of our scientific and mechanical dreams come true. You know, there's nothing supernatural or mystic about Buck. He's just an ordinary, normal human being who keeps his wits about him.
Kellogg's Pep, the super delicious cereal, presents
The Adventures of Superman. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman, and today, editor Perry White makes a decision that will bring many exciting moments to the Man of Steel.
That's the kind of thing that the guys who did sound effects absolutely adored, because they could, even in that matter of a 15-second introduction, there were like six sound effects cues. They're all going mad, but when it's done, it can be so satisfying, because you've taken people all the way around the world in 15 seconds. Except for Superman, during the 1940s, there were no other series produced that were dedicated solely to science fiction. There were a lot of individual SF scripts performed on such general series as Escape, Favorite Story, Hollywood Star Playhouse, The Mysterious Traveler, Quiet Please, and the great one, Suspense. But before we go on into past the 1940s, I want to take a step back to the most famous radio broadcast of all time. The August 1927 issue of Amazing Stories contained the reprint of a story published originally in 1895 in England by the well-known author H.G. Wells. It was called The War of the Worlds. And in that magazine, it was read by a precocious 12-year-old named Orson Welles. As director of the Mercury Radio Theater on the Air, starting about early in 1938, Welles asked writer Howard Koch to write the script for the War of the Worlds. Koch wrote it over and over again and just couldn't get it right. None of them liked how it was coming out. Finally, Welles convinced him to write it as a series of news reports, sort of like that radio coverage on the crash of the Hindenburg last year. I mean, the year before, 1937. So they planned it as a Halloween story for October 30th, 1938. Most people tuned in to, of course, the most popular radio program at that time, the Chasen Sanborn Hour. About 12 minutes into the show, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy finished their opening comic sketch and went on to the usual musical number. If everyone at that time had had their little channel switchers, they would have all gone, oop, click, but they had to get up and actually turn that dial, and many people switched their channels to see what else was on. From 12 minutes...
But I can see if the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor. At least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. Has a diameter of, what would you say, Professor Pearson?
What's that?
What would you say, what's the diameter of this?
About 30 yards.
About 30 yards. The metal on the sheath is, well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish-white. It's curious. Spectators now are pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. Getting in front of my line of vision. Would you mind standing one side, please, while the police are pushing the crowd back? Here's Mr. Wilmoth, owner of the farm here. He may have some interesting facts to add. Mr. Wilmoth, would you please tell the radio audience as much as you remember of this rather unusual visitor that dropped in your backyard? Step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmoth.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please, closer.
Yes. I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsing. That professor fellow was talking about Mars. So I was half chosen and half...
Yes, Mr. Wilmoth, and then what happened?
Well, as I was saying, I was listening to the radio, kind of halfway...
Yes, Mr. Wilmoth, and then you saw something.
Well, not first off. I heard something.
And what did you hear?
A hissing sound like this. Kind of like a 4th of July rocket.
Yes, then what?
I turned my head out the window and would have sworn I was asleep and dreaming.
Yes?
I seen a kind of greenish streak and then zingo. Something smacked the ground. knocked me clear out of my chair.
Well, were you frightened, Mr. Wilmot?
Well, I ain't quite sure. I reckon I was kind of riled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wilmot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you want me to tell
No, that's quite all right. That's plenty. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm where this thing has fallen. I wish I could convey the atmosphere, the background of this fantastic scene. Hundreds of cars are parked in a field in back of us, and the police are trying to rope off the roadway leading into the farm, but it's no use. They're breaking right through. Car's headlights throw an enormous spotlight on the pit where the object's half buried. Now, some of the more daring souls now are venturing near the edge. The silhouette stand out against the metal sheen. One man wants to touch the thing. He's having an argument with the policeman. Now, the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear the curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object? I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think. The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth, and you can see its cylindrical
shape.
Just a
minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and the thing must be hollow.
He's moving! Keep back there! Keep back there! Keep those men back! Keep back there! Keep those idiots back!
I will tell you the true meaning of that sound, of the turning of the top of the Martian cylinder. It was done with a large mason jar in a tiled bathroom in the back of the theater, and he stuck it with a microphone into a toilet so that it would echo and echo and echo. But during that program and after it, widespread panic. Police and military were called, and in places all over up and down the East Coast. Hundreds of calls came into the switchboard at the CBS studios in New York. A studio head tried to go in and have the program stopped before it could get any worse, but producer John Houseman wouldn't let him in. People around the west side of New Jersey were especially nervous, since that's where the Martians had supposedly landed. Many people were frightened, but no one died, and there were only a few minor injuries resulting from this general panic. You can see how that came about. They missed, at the beginning, all of the introduction that said, this is a radio play, okay? And after they'd heard that part of it, and then heard the heat ray that burned a few people up, after that, they announced it still twice more and again at the end during the show that this was a play, and no one heard it. The next day, Houseman and Wells held a press conference and said they had no idea what was going on out there and wondered how anyone could possibly have taken their simple play so seriously wrong. Of course, later on, we all found out that they actually did know, and personally, I think they were both quite pleased about it. The only real lasting result from that program is, of course, that everybody knows about it, but the networks banned anyone from doing a play that made use of that news technique as a premise. Oh, and the Mercury Theater program, which had been on the air since May without a sponsor, was picked up by Campbell Soups and became the Campbell Playhouse thereafter. There have been treatises and whole books devoted to the reasons and the effects of the panic broadcast. It came at the end of the Great Depression with the war brewing in Europe. Many people were feeling very uncertain about the future and about having control of their own lives and their own destinies. I think the events of the past 6 weeks in our own country help us to understand how they felt and perhaps how they could have reacted so strongly, turning what was intended as a treat into a Halloween trick. In November of 1944, a radio station in Santiago, Chile, broadcast an adaptation of the Howard Koch script, causing a widespread panic. You'd think that someone would learn from all these events, but in February of 1949, a large station, HCQRX, in Quito, Ecuador, did their own adaptation of the story and didn't bother to tell anyone, even the station management, that they were planning to do it. When the station managers heard the panicked citizens in the streets outside their studios, they went on and made the announcement that the entire program had been a hoax. A frightened and unfocused crowd now became a mob with a direction and a purpose. They showed up at the station's building with cans of gasoline and copies of a newspaper associated with that station, and they burned the building to the ground, killing 20 people. The police and military, of course, were called for protection, but they were already on their way, heading to where they could help quell the Martian invasion. Because this program is so famous, anytime a radio station wants to draw attention to itself, they say, "Hey, I know, let's do the War of the Worlds." And it has been done numerous times since then. On the 30th anniversary of the original Wells broadcast, which makes it 1968, WKBW in Buffalo, New York, decided to do their own adaptation, written and produced by Jeff Kay. He didn't write a script. He wrote an outline saying, the scene is this long. You need to get this in at the beginning and this in at the end and make it up as you go along. They relocated to their own area, and they used real news reporters from the radio and television station that were part of that system. They did a huge publicity campaign for weeks before the production, letting everyone know that it was just going to be a play and not to worry. Mostly that worked, but still some people didn't pay attention and panicked anyway. A Canadian National Guard unit was called out to guard the border crossing. It was done so realistically and so well that even people who knew it was a hoax began to have their doubts.
Hear the sound. My God, Don, there's something crawling out of the top of this thing. Something or someone. I can see two discs of some sort. They're eyes. They appear to be eyes. It might well be a face for all I know. Something's wriggling out of this capsule. Wait a minute. They're tentacles. That's what they are. I can see them now. The police lights are on them. This thing is large. The body glistens like it's soaking wet. That face, I can hardly look at it, Don. I can hardly look at it. The eyes are black. The mouth is C-shaped, and it's dripping saliva. It's finding it very difficult to move, but it's now beginning to move. The crowd's moving back. I'm moving back. I'm getting out of here.
I can see it now. I can see it, too. It's, oh, my God.
This is 393, Jim. Just what is going on out there? Now, let's get coherent. Let's cool down. Jim, what's shaking?
Hank, I'm not falling. This is it. There's some sort of a monster of sorts. Not too far from where we're standing right now. We've had to get out of the immediate area. We're moving back as far back as we can possibly move.
Jim, can't you get to Professor Moore so we can get some facts on this thing?
Hank, I tried to talk to Professor out of moving up, but he managed to talk some Army lieutenant into approaching this thing. The lieutenant himself is carrying some sort of a pole, and on this pole is a white handkerchief. And he and the professor are now approaching this monster. Good God almighty, they've been hit with some sort of a red beam. They burst into flame. The professor, the lieutenant. We're getting out of here. We gotta get out of here. The red beam is going all over the place, picking off people. One by one, the bodies are all over the place.
I find that one really hard to listen to. It's much more realistic than Orson Welles' version. There seems to be something about 10-year anniversaries of the War of the Worlds broadcast. WKBW's was in 1968. They repeated it in 1998, by the way, with essentially the same concept and even better audio technology, all done live. Jeff Wayne is a musician and composer in England, produced an elaborate Broadway-style rock musical version of The War of the Worlds in 1978, featuring Richard Burton as the journalist narrator, and music performed by guest musicians from various British rock bands. This version stuck very close to the original H.G. Wells stories, but it still had its own unique take on the subject.
Ogilvy, the astronomer, assured me we were in no danger. He was convinced there could be no living thing on that remote, forbidding planet.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one. But still, they come.
Came the night the first missile approached Earth. It was thought to be an ordinary falling star, but next day there was a huge crater in the middle of the common, and Ogilvy came to examine what lay there. A cylinder, 30 yards across, glowing hot, and with faint sounds of movement coming from within. Suddenly the top began moving, rotating, unscrewing, and Ogilvy feared there was a man inside trying to escape. He rushed to the cylinder, but the intense heat stopped him before he could burn himself on the metal.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come. Coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. Chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
How Jeff Wayne managed to get Justin Hayward, who is one of the lead singers for the Moody Blues, to play in this extravaganza is still the biggest mystery of the program. And then in 1988, David Osman of the Firesign Theater directed the 50th anniversary production of Howard Koch's original script. Howard Koch eventually maintained the copyright on this script, even though Orson Welles fought him for it for years, maintaining that Welles had written the script. Koch is perhaps better known because he won an Academy Award for writing the script of the movie Casablanca. His original War of the Worlds script was actually titled Invasion from Mars. Osman adapted the script slightly to make it more like modern public radio and added a much lighter attitude than the original as well. He used real personalities from National Public Radio as actors, and they did such a credible job that it's nearly impossible to tell where the normal public radio broadcasting ended and where the play begins. With Jason Robards as Professor Pearson, you also hear voices of Terry Gross, Scott Simon, Steve Allen, Douglas Edwards, and Hector Elizondo, among others.
Bulletins too numerous to read have been piling up here. We've been informed that the central portion of New Jersey is completely blacked out due to the effect of the heat ray weapons and power lines, electrical equipment, and so forth.
Overseas satellite communications are also out, but from radio and telephone reports, we understand that there have been possible landings near London, Paris, and Moscow. Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena reports gas eruptions at regular intervals on the planet Mars, and that would appear to be evidence of reinforcement rockets.
We've been attempting to reestablish our link with Dr. Pearson of Princeton, who was among the first to see the Martians, but we fear he may have been a casualty of renewed fighting.
And this just in from Langley Air Force Base outside of Washington. Observation aircraft report three Martian machines moving north toward the Somerville area with a panicked population fleeing ahead of them. Now that heat ray that they used with such effect earlier tonight seems not to be in use. The observers report the machines are moving at high rates of speed, but they seem to be picking their way carefully, making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities or countryside. However, they are stopping to uproot power lines, smash bridges, and to crush highways. I'm convinced, Steve, that their objective is to eliminate resistance, paralyze communication, and to disorganize human society.
Oh, very bad news, Doug. We join correspondent George Spelvin in Basking Ridge, New Jersey.
Disturbing information. Earlier this evening, hunters stumbled on a second cylinder embedded in the Great Swamp, 20 miles south of Morristown. Now we have the National Guard moving artillery along this highway in an attempt to blow up the second invading unit before the cylinder can be opened and the fighting machines rigged. They're moving past my position along Interstate 287. Towards the foothills of the Wachung Mountains. We can't get any closer, and that's all they're telling us for now.
Thank you, George. Is that more bad news, Doug?
Steve, I'm afraid it is. From Langley, airborne observers report the number of enemy machines has now increased to three north of New Brunswick, with more observed east of Middlesex. They've also picked up speed and are kicking over houses and trees, evidently hastening to form a conjunction with their allies south of Morristown in the suburbs of Newark.
Yes. Well, we have some good news at last. Langley has finally scrambled a squadron of fighter bombers to rendezvous with the rapidly moving enemy.
Well, that ought to end the matter, at least locally.
Yes, I hope so. And now we'll hear directly from Langley Tower Communications.
501, 501 Voodoo, this is Langley.
This is Voodoo. Langley, this is Voodoo. Our vector is 080 for bogeys.
Roger, Voodoo.
Voodoo, this is Bozo.
Talk to me, Bozo.
Three bogeys heading
203. Roger, I got him.
Voodoo, this is Rosebud. Make that six bogeys. We have three machines heading from Morristown, vicinity Patterson.
That's a roger, Rosebud. Maintain visual contact.
Roger.
Voodoo, this is Bozo.
Go ahead.
I'm bringing it to the left to get a closer look. We can see ground fire from Army Battery in Sector Roscoe. Dog, early. Oh, he took a hit. Bogey is hit. Voodoo, Voodoo.
Roger, Bozo. Understood. Langley, this is Voodoo. Heavy black fog, very dense, of unknown nature, moving east-northeast from machines, hanging close to the earth. Battery and offensive ground fire now nullified.
Voodoo, Voodoo, this is Maverick. I got three bogeys crossing Passaic River into the Jersey marshes. Look out, Meadowland.
Perhaps you noticed one of the lighter touches in that little thing. One of the fighter pilots says, this is Rosebud. If you remember, Rosebud is the last word on the lips of the star of Citizen Kane as he dies. It's his sled. There's a well-known theater company in Los Angeles called, strangely enough, L.A. Theater Works, which did yet another production of the Howard Koch script in 1994. It was directed by John DeLancey and starred Leonard Nimoy and featured many performances by a number of the members of the cast from the Star Trek television series. Personally, I don't feel this one lived up to the multi-star billing, and it wasn't nearly as good as either Osman's version or the WKBW version of that script. I maintain a website that includes a page covering many of these versions of The War of the Worlds and a number of others. I do know a fellow who claims to have more than 25 different versions of The War of the Worlds, and it points at dozens of other pages on the web that cover various aspects of the work. About four times a year, I get email from someone asking where they can obtain rights to perform this version of the Howard Koch script. It took me a while, but I eventually found a lawyer in California who handles the rights. He's retired in everything else, but he handles the rights for the War of the Worlds script for Howard Koch's wife, Anne. Now, I just send people directly to the lawyer, so I don't have to, because I don't know what else to tell them. And there is a group in New York who was supposed to perform another version of this script, at least another presentation of this script, earlier this month. But there were so many people's schedules who were messed up in New York, they decided to postpone it. It will probably happen again eventually. So we've been through 1938 and up to 1988 and 94 now. Now we're going to jump back to where we were. By 1950, radio was changing. Television was starting to erode the audience, and radio was trying desperately to hold on by creating more adult fare to keep up. Tom Mix and the Ralston Six and the Ralston. Anybody remember the rest of that? The Ralston. I think it's the Ralston Six Shooters. Straight Shooters. The Ralston Straight Shooters. I couldn't remember the name of his show. Now had turned from a kids' Western, and now instead, after 1950, they were doing Gunsmoke and much more adult fare on the radio. The success of a hit film, Destination Moon, with a script partially written by the father of modern science fiction, Robert Heinlein, sparked a great surge in science fiction everywhere, particularly on the radio, and the year 1950 saw the premiere of several new series. ABC Network came out with a serial aimed at the slightly older kids called Space Patrol with Buzz Corey. The Mutual Network premiered 2,000-plus in March, offering Adventures in the World of Tomorrow, dramatic stories of science fiction from the years beyond 2000 AD. This anthology series ran for 2 years. In April of 1950, CBS started Beyond Tomorrow, another anthology series that ran for 2 months. And then in July, they tried again with one called Cloud Nine that lasted only 3 weeks, and I've never found anyone who has a copy of a tape from that series. But the real gem of that season was the NBC offering Dimension X. They went to the science fiction magazines because that's where all the best stories were coming from. Most of the scripts were written by Ernest Canoy and George Lefferts, who were not only good at adapting a great short story, but they were familiar with the field of science fiction as well. And the stories were selected were some of the best by the top writers of the time, like Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon, and Clifford Simak. Now, science fiction is a literature of ideas. Very often, they have to build the universe, the world in which the story takes place. And that is a very slow kind of thing. Given that and the limitations of a half-hour radio show, many of the stories used on these programs took a lot of time conveying the science fictional ideas, and the character development was only kind of squeezed in and stuck in where it would fit, and there wasn't always much time left for that. But the ideas were powerful, and stories and plots were often more sophisticated than most other radio fare. I'm going to play for you an excerpt from a program of Dimension X. This is from a story by Robert Sheckley, who is sort of the comedian of science fiction writers at the time. This is about a world where colonists have long been out of touch with Earth and have developed their own culture. But now an inspector from old Earth is coming, and the colonists don't want to seem like they're aliens. So we get this scene from Sheckley's Skulking Permit.
That is all.
Well, you see how it is, Tom. Now, Tom, about your job. I'm appointing you town criminal.
I don't see why there has to be a criminal.
That's a very important part of Earth society. All the books say so, Tom. The criminal is as important as the postman or the police chief. He works against society. If you don't have people working against society, how can you have people working for it? How can there be any more important job?
Well, I don't want to do it.
Now, be reasonable, Tom. Put yourself in my position. This inspector comes and he meets Billy Painter, our police chief. He asks to see the jail. Then he says, no prisoners? How can I hold my head up and tell him that we don't have any crime? No crime, he'll say. But Earth colonies always have crime. Don't you see that, Tom? Right there, the whole thing falls through. He'll see that we're not truly Earth-like. We're faking it. We're aliens. And you heard what he said about being rough on aliens.
Well, yeah, but why me?
Can't spare anyone else. And you've got narrow eyes. Criminals always have narrow eyes.
Well, they aren't that narrow.
Tom, please, we're all doing our part. You want to help now, don't you?
Oh, I suppose so.
Fine, you're our criminal. Here, I've got this paper all made out for you, just to make it legal.
Skulking permit.
No, all men by these presents that Tom Fisher is a duly authorized thief and murderer. He is hereby required to skulk in dismal alleys, haunt places of low repute, and to break the law.
Yeah, what's the law?
I'll let you know as fast as I make them up. All Earth colonies have laws.
Well, what do I do?
You steal and kill. Look, I'll give you a couple of books on it. Steal as much as you like. One murder should be enough. Don't overdo it.
It don't sound sensible somehow.
Well, you can work up to it, Tom. Why don't you start off easy, like by haunting a place of low repute?
Dimension X ran for 3 seasons, ending in September 1951 with Isaac Asimov's noted story Nightfall, which has since then been voted as the best science fiction story of all time. The next few years were kind of a dry spell after 1952. There were only such young people's SF programs as Tom Corbett's Space Cadet. Adults found science fiction themes occasionally in such anthology series as Escape, Lights Out, Suspense, and The Shadow, which originally starred Orson Welles. But Orson didn't last long on that. For one thing, he went on to higher things. And for another, they had to get somebody else to do the evil laugh because Orson couldn't do it right. The laugh of, crime does not pay. That evil. Orson Welles couldn't laugh like that. The 1950s were a time of great interest in science. SF pulp magazines were very popular, and there were plenty of true sci-fi films around. Common themes in these B-movies were alien monsters invading Earth, either overtly or secretly. Earth people traveling to other planets and finding monsters. And atomic radiation mutating something into monsters. Plenty of monsters. Films were very narrow in their view of what was science fiction. Science always comes back to bite you. The magazines had a very broad view and were very good at what they did. The radio programs were sort of in between. They had the magazine's broad view of story ideas, but they tended toward a rather stylized format with narrator introductions and a matter-of-fact style of writing and acting.
Adventures in time and space, told in future tense.
Dimension X, 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 X.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3. X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of Astounding Science Fiction, presents...
X minus one.
Dimension X was revived on NBC in 1955 under that title, X Minus One. It used the same writers, same crew, and many of the same regular cast members as before, and even did many of the same scripts over again. But they also added a lot of new stories. And remember, even up into the mid-1950s, almost all radio drama was still performed live, not pre-recorded. Nearly all of the shows from this series, I know of 79, are available from collectors and commercial sources. This is an excerpt from one of the very best of the X-1 stories, a Robert Heinlein story called Universe. It had to establish the concept of a generation starship, where whole generations lived and died before the ship reached its destination because of the distance between stars. And on this ship, the goal has been lost in a mutiny hundreds of years ago.
Enter, Mr. Harlan.
This is where you live?
Yes.
But you have books.
Stolen from your libraries, Mr. Harlan.
Compton's Astrophysics. The Philosophy of Interstellar Navigation. Celestial Mechanics. You have read these?
Most of them.
Why did you bring me here? What do you intend to do?
You believe in Jordan, Mr. Harlan.
There is no other belief.
And the trip? I suppose you believe in the trip, too.
Well, what else is there to believe? When you die, your remains are fed to the converter and your soul makes the trip.
And where does the trip take you?
Why... to Centaurus, of course.
Huh? Well, what is Centaurus?
Why, Centaurus, mind you, I'm just telling you the orthodox answer. Centaurus is where you arrive when you've made the trip. A place where everything is happy and everybody's happy and there's always good eating. It's mythological, of course.
And you believe this?
The peasants believe it, literally, but many of the younger scientists like myself know that it's figurative, symbolic. Why do you ask?
Didn't it ever occur to you, Mr. Harlan, that the trip is exactly what your peasants believe it is? That the ship and all the crew were actually going someplace? Moving?
The ship can't go anywhere. It already is everywhere.
Imagine a place bigger than the ship, much bigger, with the ship inside it, moving inside.
But there can't be any place bigger than the ship. There wouldn't be any place for it to be.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Listen, you know the lowest level?
Yes.
If you started digging a hole in the lowest level, where would that hole go?
Where would that hole... Oh, no. No, it's forbidden to think such a thought.
Where would it go?
No. No, I can't think about it.
Bobo! Bobo, we're going to take Mr. Harlan to the place.
Where are we going?
To the top level.
But it's certain death.
Nonsense, I've been there 1,000 times. Come along.
No, I won't. You can't make me.
I think we can.
Oh, I'm such a tease. I just love leading you up to that point and then leaving you there. You'll have to get a copy of that particular one. They're available. I wrote some websites on here. There's one called radiospirits.com. They carry lots of X-1. X-1 ran through 1957. Just a month before it ended, a new series debuted called Exploring Tomorrow. This Mutual Network series was hosted by John W. Campbell, who was the most heralded editor of the most prestigious SF magazine, Astounding. But the series couldn't live up to what had gone before. Over at NBC, they said that X-1 was never the most important responsibility we had in the shop. But it was the office pet, not only for the writers and editors, but for the directors, sound men, and the engineers. So X-1 was just so good because it was done out of love. Then there was a great drought. An attempt was made in 1973 to revive X-1, but it only lasted a couple of months, and then again was gone. During the late 70s, there was a series that ran briefly called Alien Worlds, which was largely written by a fellow named J. Michael Straczynski, who was the creator of a TV show of recent times called Babylon 5. He got his start writing in radio. That's a hint for all of you writers. The stories had continuing characters on Alien Worlds, and they were very imaginative, but there were only about a dozen hour-long programs made, and then it, too, disappeared beneath the surface without a ripple. Then, in 1977, along came a new film called Star Wars, suddenly casting light into that dark corner of science fiction. The next year in England, a young fellow named Douglas Adams, who had worked with the Monty Python group occasionally, wrote a series destined to have a long life of its own. This was called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The Hitchhiker's Guide started out as a 6-episode series on the BBC radio. It was so popular that another Christmas special show was commissioned, and then 5 more shows to complete a second series. No one had expected this. But Adams had done something quite unique. He had taken that comic sensibility of the Monty Python's gang and infused it with a true appreciation of science and science fiction, and he had made the most superbly imagined parody. This is a scene from the first series of Hitchhiker's Guide, where we discover something new about the creation of the Earth. We find the philosopher pundits talking to their great computer, Deep Thought.
"75,000 generations ago, our ancestors set this program in motion.
An awesome prospect. Deep Thought prepares to speak.
Good evening.
Good evening, old Deep Thought. Do you have...
an answer for you?
Yes.
Yes, I have.
There really is one.
There really is one.
To everything? To the great question of life, the universe, and everything?
Yes.
And are you ready to give it to us?
I am.
Now?
Now.
Wow.
Though I don't think you're going to like it.
It doesn't matter. We must know it.
Now?
Yes, now.
All right.
Well?
You're really not going to like it.
Tell us.
All right. The answer to everything.
Yes?
Life, the universe, and everything.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
42.
We are going to get lynched, you know that.
It was a tough assignment.
42?
I think the problem, such as it was too broadly based. You never actually stated what the question was.
Well, it was the ultimate question, the question of life, the universe, and everything.
Exactly. Now you know that the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is 42. All you need to do now is find out what the ultimate question is.
All right. Can you please tell us the question?
The ultimate question.
Yes.
Of life, the universe...
And everything?
And everything.
Yes.
Tricky.
But can you do it?
No.
Oh, God.
But I'll tell you who can.
Who? Tell us. Tell us.
Who is...
I speak of none but the computer that is to come after me.
What computer?
A computer whose nearest operational parameters I am not worthy to calculate, and yet I will design it for you.
Really? That?
A computer which can calculate the question to the ultimate answer. A computer of such infinite and subtle complexity that organic life itself will form part of its operational matrix, and it shall be called the Earth.
Huh. What a dull name.
The Hitchhiker's Guide stories spawned a series of books of pretty much the same story, although Douglas Adams says that the entire second six episodes of the Hitchhiker's Guide radio show are mentioned in about two lines in the first book, and then moved on. Then there were was a six-episode television series, and there were more books, and it came full circle when Douglas Adams read his own books, making books on tape, thereby bringing it back to audio. He always maintained that the radio version was always his favorite. 2 weeks before he died in May of this year, he had finished a screenplay, or yet another screenplay, of The Hitchhiker's Guide. Who knows if the movie will ever actually be made. Thus endeth the 1970s. There is a concept. In 1980s, there was a remarkable decade for science fiction audio. In 1981, Lucasfilms and National Public Radio made a radio series of the first Star Wars movie, using the film's original music and sound effects and some of the original cast. To fill 13 episodes, they had to actually expand the story, so there are characters, events, and relationships that only appear briefly or are not even mentioned in the film. Scripts were written by science fiction writer Brian Daley, and the series was directed by John Madden, who went on to direct the film Shakespeare in Love. Eventually, all three Star Wars movies were made into audio and broadcast numerous times on National Public Radio. In 1982, another new star appeared in the firmament of SF audio. Thomas Lopez at ZBS Studios in upstate New York wrote and produced a series of 3-minute episodes of Ruby, The Adventures of a Galactic Gumshoe. Lopez has a remarkable ear for sound and music, and he combined these with a female film noir hard-boiled detective in a zany world on the planet Sumanula, which means the high point of nothing. He made it all in 3-minute episodes because that's what radio stations said they wanted, something they could air that didn't take any longer than the average pop song. Lopez managed to make the dialogue, the sound effects, and the music all blend together in one harmonious whole. This is one episode from the first series of Ruby the Galactic Gumshoe, in which Ruby disarms.
The Adventures of Ruby.
Here I am, stuck in a force field, deep down inside a hollow volcano.
We've got you now, Ruby.
Very funny. The two techno-witches, Anofan and Ofanaf, are getting their yucks off. Hey, how about turning off your force field, huh? Well, it's not easy being a stand-up comic in outer space.
We have to ask you to disarm, slowly. Very slowly.
Sure, no problem.
First, on your right hip, your Smith Hitachi Godzilla blaster.
Right.
That's fine. Under your left arm, the armpit Dillinger laser.
Right.
Your right thigh, the explosive blastoids.
Right.
Fine. Your right ankle, the stun gasser.
Right.
Left thigh, sonic immobilizer.
Right.
Left arm, Hominger dagger.
Right.
Right leg, foldable boomer bolo.
Aww. Right.
Left wrist, the heat-seeking ditto darts.
Right.
The toe grenades.
Right.
We ought to check our teeth.
Uh-uh. I feel naked.
Who hired you?
A Kapurian.
Who's behind him?
I'm trying to find out.
What do you want?
I told you. I'm trying to find out who's manipulating the media on this planet.
There is a conspiracy going on and you know about it.
You're the ones that told me there isn't a conspiracy.
Did we tell her that?
Yes, on Monday.
Will you cut this force field? It's loosening my teeth.
All right.
Come on up. We will fall.
They dim the spots. I ride the spiral up. By the looks of things, they padded the shell of this volcano with some pinkish, absorbent, weird stuff. I don't know what they're up to, but I'll try to find out for you.
Ruby has had many adventures. That was Ruby 1 we just heard. Ruby 6 will be available in the ZBS catalog this fall. Also during the 1980s, radio station WHA produced a 15-part series of Walter M. Miller's classic science fiction novel, A Canticle for Leibowitz. It's a story of monks in the Abbey of St. Leibowitz in the desert southwest, trying to keep alive mankind's knowledge after a nuclear holocaust. This wonderful series hasn't been heard since it first appeared in 1984, and just last month, I heard that new rights have been obtained, and it will be broadcast again early next year on National Public Radio. If you have a station around here that broadcasts National Public Radio and it does not carry NPR Playhouse, after tonight I hope you will go and call them up and demand that they start playing it. It'll probably be the first station added back to their list in a long time. In 1987... Kevin Singer produced a 26-part series of classic science fiction stories for public broadcasting called Sci-Fi Radio. A serious misnomer, since it included stories by authors heard on radio before, like Ray Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke, but it also introduced a number of new authors to audio, like Roger Zelazny and Cordwainer Smith and James Tiptree Jr., much more modern writers. We hope that someday the rights for this series will be revived, and we can again hear those stories on the air. We're almost up to today. The 1990s didn't see any large programs except the Ruby series continuing, coming from ZBS, but there were quite a few small groups around the country producing science fiction, fantasy, and horror. The Atlanta Radio Theater Company in Georgia did a number of original science fiction works and several adaptations of stories by H.P. Lovecraft and H.G. Wells, largely because they're in the public domain, I'm sure. A program called Shockwave in Minneapolis did performances of original comic science fiction at their annual convention. The Star Trek and Star Wars franchises also released a large number of audio books during the 90s and an occasional full-cast production. Sometimes adaptations of a book or a story, and very occasionally an original audio work from the Star Trek or Star Wars series, or genre anyway, their universe. For a few years, the sci-fi cable channel, television channel, operated the Seeing Ear Theater, a worldwide website dedicated to audio SF, producing many stories of their own, original ones, for distribution only on the World Wide Web. They did put out several of them on tape, and then kind of changed their point of view and did a lot of stories that were all famous writers, and they would bring in well-known actors, mostly from New York, since that's where they're located. But I have heard recently that the Sci-Fi Channel got bought by somebody else and pulled the plug on that. So Sci-Fi Radio is finishing up the contracts that they have outstanding, and then they will probably just sit there and nothing new will be added to the website. In 1997, a few individuals created the Mark Time Awards for the Best Science Fiction Audio Production of the Year. There have been more than a dozen winners from the more than 50 entries in this annual competition, which now includes the Ogle Award for Best Fantasy Audio Production. Charles Ogle was the actor who played Frankenstein's monster in Thomas Edison's 1910 silent version of Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein. It's quite a gruesome sight and really, really different than Boris Karloff. And in New Jersey, the Radio Repertory Company of America produced two lighthearted SF series, making use of well-known stars to garner attention for them. The Flight of the Bumblebee featured Marina Sirtis, who was Counselor Troy on the Star Trek The Next Generation, and Lives of the Cat featuring Claudia Christian, one of the stars of Babylon 5. Just this year, they released a new sequel to the Lives of the Cat story called Anne Manx and the Ring of Minotaur, featuring the same characters and including Claudia Christian. Well worth listening to, lots of fun. But the largest event in the new millennium has been the Hollywood Theater of the Ears series 2000X. Producer Yuri Rosofsky in Los Angeles assembled 26 full-hour programs for NPR featuring stories of the next millennium. What, does that sound familiar? The series includes stories from as far back as Edgar Rice Burroughs' 1920s novel, The Moon Maid, and it includes Harlan Ellison's award-winning story, Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man, featuring Robin Williams as the Harlequin. That's a wonderful thing. Yuri told me it was the best work he had ever done. This series is currently being repeated on National Public Radio's Playhouse. If you are interested in more about this, I can tell you a number of things. First of all, there's websites written up here. Of course, you can't see them right now. But greatnorthernaudio.com is a website that includes a whole section on science fiction radio. It covers a lot of what I've talked about here and way more. There are there's a whole book written about science fiction on radio from 1930 to 1970, which has intimate details of every Dimension X and X minus one and Exploring Tomorrow, all of those including cast members, writers, when they were broadcast, when they were repeated, who wrote the script, what the story's about, way more than anyone would ever really want to know unless you're writing a book. If you're interested in the War of the Worlds, there is this terrific book, which is also available on the web from a place called sourcebooks.com, which is called The Complete War of the Worlds, and it even includes a compact disc, which has the entire Wells War of the Worlds, some of WKBW's War of the Worlds, and most of the press conference that Wells and Houseman held the day after their well-known broadcast. The ZBS.org is available, and you can pick up any of the Ruby series and all of the other stuff that he's done there. There's a place called Lodestone Media, which carries almost everything I've talked about and way more on the web. Most of what they carry is modern-day science fiction, though they have a little bit of older stuff, and everything the Fire Sign Theater has available is through them, for those of you who have heard of the Fire Sign Theater. And there's Radio Spirits, which specializes in old-time radio, and they carry all of the X-1, Dimension X, Tom Corbett, Space Patrol. They carry everything that is available through them, and of course that's radiospirits.com, if you wanted to look all those up. I also have phone numbers for many of them if you're interested in that. Well, there you are. That is a... you're all up to date on science fiction on in audio. To finish this off, I've got a piece that I think is really fun but doesn't sort of fit into anything else that we've talked about. This is from an album by the Fire Sign Theater in 1975 called Everything You Know Is Wrong. And it's about, the whole album is about the sort of strange people on Earth who claim to have seen UFOs. This is an army training film about what to do if the aliens arrive.
Classified, ultra secret, Air Force generals only. Turn hut! At ease, men, take your seat.
This is General Curtis Goathart. If you are viewing this film, then we are under extraterrestrial attack. Beware. Your brain may no longer be the boss. If you are beginning to doubt what I am saying, you are probably hallucinating. Listen carefully.
What to do if an alien appears? One.
Drop under the seat of your plane and look away.
Two.
Avoid eye contact.
Three.
If there are no eyes, avoid all contact.
How to identify alleged sightings? One.
Pie plates or as reflections in the atmosphere.
Two.
Dry cleaning bags filled with marsh gas or...
Three.
Mass insanity.
How to inform your wife and others under your command.
Can I freshen that up for you?
I don't know how she got that requisition.
Oh, she gets it. She gets it in Nepal.
Well, she's not allowed to have it unless she...
Honey,
she's related to the
honey. People of the PX, though.
Oh, General?
Honey and men, I have something awesome to reveal to you.
Oh, well, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
Two flying saucers have just landed on my plate.
Well, turn away, sir. I'll eat them.
Good day.
Men, our greatest fear is realized. We are under attack from superior consciousness.
The eggs, sir?
They're only the beginning.
Well, can I ask what's the
PX? All right, men. Questions?
Sir?
Yes, Major?
Pass the syrup, General?
It's over here.
That's a good idea, Chuck. But syrup won't stop them.
But,
next.
Sir?
Colonel?
Are you nuts?
That is just exactly what they want you to believe.
The, eggs, sir?
Let's just call them the phenomena.
Well, if I may respectfully submit, sir, I think you've got your phenomena scrambled, General.
What about my eggs, dear?
Honey, they're in everybody's eggs.
Good Lord.
You're making me cry, General. Perhaps you'd like
to... I think I'm going to have to...
Another cup of coffee, sir. Settle down a bit.
Conclusion!
They think he is insane. Yet, he outranks them. His option, command.
One.
He seals off the area.
Two.
Secures the cooperation of local officials.
Three.
Obtains expert scientific assistance.
Four.
Evacuates all government employees.
Five.
And bombs aliens back to stone.